Chapter 6 of John Brown by W.E. Burghardt Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Call of Kansas. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voices like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. Just 300 years before John Brown pledged his family to warfare against slavery, a black man stood on the plains of the Southwest, looking toward Kansas. It was the Negro Stephen, once slave of Durantes, now leader and interpreter of the Fray Marcos explorers, and the first man of the Old World to look upon the great Southwest, if not upon Kansas itself. Whiter men have since ignored and ridiculed his work. Sensualists have charged him with sensuality. Lords of greed have called him greedy. And yet, withal, the plain truth remains. He led the expedition that foreran Coronado, reported back the truth of what he saw, and then returned to lay down his life among the savages. The land he looked upon in those young years of the 16th century was big with the tragic fate of his people. Planted far to the eastward a century later, their dark faces traveled fast westward until slavery was secure in the valley of the Mississippi and in the lower Southwest. Then the slave barons looked behind them and saw to their own dismay that there could be no backward step. The slavery of the new cotton kingdom in the 19th century must either die or conquer a nation. It could not hesitate or pause. It was an industrial system built on ignorance, force, and the cotton plant. The slaves must be curbed with an iron hand. A moment of relaxation, and lo, they would be rising either in revenge or ambition. And slavery had made revenge and ambition one. Such a system could not compete with intelligence, nor with individual freedom, nor with miscellaneous and care-demanding crops. It could not divide territory with these things. To do so meant economic death and the sudden, perhaps revolutionary upheaval of a whole social system. This the South saw as it looked backward in the years from 1820 to 1840. Then its bolder vision pressed the gloom ahead, and dreamed a dazzling dream of empire. It saw the slave system triumphant in the great Southwest, in Mexico, in Central America, and the islands of the sea. Its softer souls, timid with a fear prophetic of failure, still held half-heartedly back. But bolder leaders like Davis, Toombs, and Floyd went relentlessly, ruthlessly on. Three steps they and their forerunners took in that great western wilderness, and other steps were planned. Three steps that cost uncounted treasure in gold and blood. The first in 1820, when they set foot beyond the Mississippi into Missouri. The second and bolder when they set their seal on the spoils of raped Mexico and made it possible slave soil. And the third and boldest when on the soil of Kansas they fought to enslave all territory of the Union. That these steps would cost much, the leaders knew, but they did not rightly reckon how much. They risked the upheaval of parties, the enmity of sections, and the angry agitation of visionaries. If worse came to worst, they held the trump card of disrupting the nation and founding a mighty slave aristocracy to stretch from the Ohio to Venezuela, and from Cuba to Texas. One thing alone they did not count upon, and that was armed force. The three steps did raise tremendous opposition. The enslaving of Missouri gave birth to the early abolitionists, the conscience of the nation, awakened to find slavery not dead or dying, but growing and aggressive. And in these days, John Brown, typifying one phase of that terrible conscience, swore blood feud with this sum of all villainies. Thus the first step cost. The second step went some ways awry since California was lost to slavery, but a new law to catch runaways brought compensation, and brought too redoubled cost, for it raised in opposition to the whole slave system not only abolitionists, but free soilers, those who hated not slavery, but slaves. This was a costlier move, for the sneers that checked philanthropy were powerless against democracy, and when the echoes of this step reached the ears of John Brown, he laid aside all and became the man of one idea, and that idea the extinction of slavery in the United States. But it was the third step that was costliest, the step that sought to impose slavery by law and blood on free labor lands, despite the land's wish. Of all the steps, it was the wildest and most foolish, for it arrayed against slavery not only philanthropy and democracy, but all the world-old forces of plain justice. It compelled those who loved the right to meet law and force by force and lawlessness. And one man that led that lawless fight on the plains of Kansas and struck its bloodiest blow was John Brown. John Brown's decision to go to Kansas was sudden. Unexpectedly, the center of the slavery battle had swung westward. A shrewd bidder for the presidency offered the South the unawaited bribe of Kansas Territory for their votes, and they eagerly sprang at the offer. Stephen Douglas drove the bill through Congress, and Kansas stood ready for its slave population. But not only for slaves, also for freemen, as Eli Thayer quickly saw, and the representations of him and his associates aroused the sons of John Brown. John Brown himself looked on with interest, but he had other plans. He wrote to his son John, "If you or any of my family are disposed to go to Kansas or Nebraska with a view to help defeat Satan and his legions in that direction, I have not a word to say, but I feel committed to operate in another part of the field. If I were not so committed, I would be on my way this fall." John Brown's plans were in the Alleghenies. At North Elba lay his northern stronghold, and at Harper's Ferry lay the gates to the Great Black Way. Here, he was convinced, was the keystone of the slavery arch, and here he must strike. So in former years, Gabriel and Turner believed. So in after years, others believed. But it was not till Grant floated down this path in a sea of blood that slavery finally fell. The sons of John Brown were, however, greatly attracted by the new western lands. His eldest son writes, "During the years of 1853 and 1854, most of the leading northern newspapers were not only full of glowing accounts of the extraordinary fertility, healthfulness, and beauty of the territory of Kansas, then newly opened for settlement, but of urgent appeals to all lovers of freedom who desired homes in a new region, to go there as settlers, and by their votes save Kansas from the curse of slavery." Influenced by these considerations, in the month of October 1854, five of the sons of John Brown, John Jr., Jason, Owen, Frederick, and Salmon, then residents of the state of Ohio, made their arrangements to emigrate to Kansas. Their combined property consisted chiefly of 11 head of cattle, mostly young, and 3 horses. 10 of this number were valuable on account of the breed. Thinking these especially desirable in a new country, Owen, Frederick, and Salmon took them by way of the lakes to Chicago, thence to Meridosha, Illinois, where they were wintered, and in the following spring drove them into Kansas to a place selected by these brothers for settlement, about 8 miles west of the town of Osawatomie. My brother Jason and his family, and I with my family, followed at the opening of navigation in the spring of 1855, going by way of Ohio and Mississippi rivers to St. Louis. There we purchased 2 small tents, a plow, and some smaller farming tools, and a handmill for grinding corn. At this period there were no railroads west of St. Louis. our journey must be continued by boat on the Missouri at a time of extremely low water, or by stage at great expense. We chose the river route, taking passage on the steamer New Lucy, which too late we found crowded with passengers, mostly men from the South, bound for Kansas. That they were from the South was plainly indicated by their language and dress, while their drinking, profanity, and display of revolvers and bowie knives, openly worn as an essential part of their makeup, clearly showed the class to which they belonged, and that their mission was to aid in establishing slavery in Kansas. A box of fruit trees and grapevines, which my brother Jason had brought from Ohio, our plow, and the few agricultural implements we had on the deck of that steamer, looked lonesome, for these were all we could see which were adapted to the occupation of peace. Then, for the first time, arose in our minds the query, must the fertile prairies of Kansas, through a struggle at arms, be first secured to freedom before free men can sow and reap? If so, how poorly we were prepared for such work will be seen when I say that for arms, five of us brothers had only two small squirrel rifles and one revolver. But before we reached our destination, other matters claimed our attention. Cholera, which then prevailed to some extent at St. Louis, broke out among our passengers, a number of whom died. Among these, Brother Jason's son Austin, aged 4 years, the elder of his two children, fell a victim to this scourge, and while our boat lay by for repair of a broken rudder at Waverly, Missouri, we buried him at night near the panic-stricken town, our lonely way illumined only by the lightning of a furious thunderstorm. True to his spirit of hatred of northern people, our captain, without warning to us on shore, cast off his lines and left us to make our way by stage to Kansas City, to which place we had already paid our fare by boat. Before we reached there, however, we became very hungry and endeavored to buy food at various farmhouses on the way. But the occupants, judging from our speech that we were not from the South, always denied us, saying, "We have nothing for you." The only exception to this answer was at the stage house at Independence, Missouri. Arrived in Kansas, her lovely prairies and wooded streams seemed to us indeed like a haven of rest. Here in prospect we saw our cattle increased to hundreds and possibly to thousands, fields of corn, orchards, and vineyards. At once we set about the work through which only our visions of prosperity could be realized. Our tents would suffice to shelter until we could plow our land, plant corn and other crops, fruit trees and vines, cut and secure as hay enough of the waving grass to supply our stock the coming winter. These cheering prospects beguiled our labors through the late spring until midsummer, by which time nearly all of our number were prostrated by fever and ague that would not stay cured. The grass cut for hay moldered in the wet for the want of the care we could not bestow, and our crop of corn wasted by cattle we could not restrain. If these minor ills and misfortunes were all, they could be easily borne. But now began to gather the dark clouds of war. An election for a first territorial legislature had been held on the 30th of March of this year. On that day, the residents of Missouri along the borders came into Kansas by thousands and took forcible possession of the polls. In the words of Horace Greeley, there was no disguise, no pretense of legality, no regard for decency. On the evening before and the day of the election, nearly 1,000 Missourians arrived at Lawrence in wagons and on horseback, well armed with rifles, pistols, and bowie knives, and 2 pieces of cannon loaded with musket balls. Although but 831 legal electors in the territory voted, there were no less than 6,320 votes polled. They elected all the members of the legislature, with a single exception in either house, the 2 free soilers being chosen from a remote district which the Missourians overlooked or did not care to reach. Early in the spring and summer of this year, the actual settlers at their convention repudiated this fraudulently chosen legislature and refused to obey its enactments. Upon this, the border papers of Missouri, in flaming appeals, urged the ruffian horde that had previously invaded Kansas to arm, and otherwise prepare to march again into the territory when called upon, as they soon would be, to aid in enforcing laws. War of some magnitude, at least, now appeared to us brothers to be inevitable, and I wrote to our father, whose home was in North Elba, New York, asking him to procure and send us, if he could, arms and ammunition, so that we could be better prepared to defend ourselves and our neighbors. John Brown hesitated. His fighting blood was stirred, and yet there was the plan of years yet unrealized. Then a new vision dawned in his mind. Perhaps this was the call of the Lord, and the path to Virginia might be through Kansas. He hurriedly consulted his friends, Douglas, McCune Smith, the cultured Negro physician of New York, and Gerrit Smith, and in November 1854 wrote home, "I feel still pretty much determined to go back to North Elba, but expect Owen and Frederick will set out for Kansas on Monday next, with cattle belonging to John, Jason, and themselves, intending to winter somewhere in Illinois. Gerrit Smith wishes me to go back to North Elba. From Douglas and Dr. McCune Smith, I have not yet heard." His business delayed him in Ohio, and he still wrote of his going to North Elba. Then followed the Syracuse Convention of Abolitionists, and a new revelation to John Brown. For the first time, he came into contact with the great abolition movement. He found that money was forthcoming. Here were men willing to pay if others would work. It was the call of God, and he answered, "Here am I." Redpath says, "When in session, John Brown appeared in that convention and made a very fiery speech, during which he said he had four sons in Kansas and had three others who were desirous of going there to aid in fighting the battles of freedom. He could not consent to go unless he could go armed, and he would like to arm all his sons, but his poverty prevented him from doing so. Funds were contributed on the spot, principally by Gerrit Smith." He writes joyfully home, "Dear wife and children, I reached here on the first day of the convention, and I have reason to bless God that I came, for I have met with a most warm reception from all, so far as I know, and, except by a few sincere, honest peace friends, a most hearty approval of my intention of arming my sons and other friends in Kansas. I received today donations amounting to a little over $60, 20 from Gerrit Smith, 5 from an old British officer, others giving smaller sums, with such earnest and affectionate expression of their good wishes as did me more good than money even. John's two letters were introduced, and read with such effect by Gerrit Smith as to draw tears from numerous eyes in the great collection of people present. The convention has been one of the most interesting meetings I ever attended in my life, and I made a great addition to the number of warm-hearted and honest friends." The die was cast, and John Brown left for Kansas. Instead of sending the money in arms, says his son John, he came on with them himself, accompanied by his brother-in-law Henry Thompson and my brother Oliver. In Iowa he bought a horse and covered wagon, concealing the arms in this and conspicuously displaying his surveying implements. He crossed into Missouri near Waverly, and at that place disinterred the body of his grandson and brought all safely through to our settlement, arriving there about the 6th of October, 1855. His daughter says, "On leaving us finally to go to Kansas that summer, he said, 'If it is so painful for us to part with the hope of meeting again, how dreadful must be the feelings of hundreds of poor slaves who are separated for life.'" So John Brown reached Kansas to strike the blow for freedom. Not that he was the central figure of Kansas territorial history, so far as casual eyes could see, or the acknowledged leader of men and measures. Rather, he seemed and was but a humble co-worker, appearing and disappearing here and there, now startling men with the grim decision of his actions, now lost and hidden from public view. But it is not always the apparent leaders who do the world's work. More often, those who sit in high places, whom men see and hear, do but represent or mask public opinion and the social conscience, while down in the blood and dust of battle stoop those who delivered the master stroke, the makers of the thoughts of men. So in Kansas, Robinson, Lane, Atchison, and Geary were the conspicuous public leaders. Robinson, the canny Yankee, whose astute reading of the signs of the times proved in the end wise and correct, but left him always the opportunist and politician. Lane, whose inauspicious daring and rough devotion led thousands of immigrants out of the North and drove hundreds of slaveholders back to Missouri. Atchison, who led the determination and ruffianism of the South. And Geary, who voiced the saner nation. And yet one cannot read Kansas history without feeling that the man who in all this bewildering broil was least the puppet of circumstances, the man who most clearly saw the real crux of the conflict, most definitely knew his own convictions, and was readiest at the crisis for decisive action, was a man whose leadership lay not in his office, wealth, or influence, but in the white flame of his utter devotion to an ideal. To comprehend this, one must pick from the confused tangle of Kansas territorial history the main thread of its unraveling, and then show how Brown's life twined with it. And this is no easy task. Sometime before or after 1850, Southern leaders had tacitly fixed the westward extension of the Compromise Line of 1820 at the northern line of Missouri. When, then, the bill for organizing this western territory appeared innocently in Congress, it was hustled back to committee, and appeared finally as the celebrated Kansas-Nebraska bill, which formed two territories, Kansas and Nebraska. It was the secret understanding of the promoters of the bill that Kansas would become slave territory and Nebraska free, and this tacit compact was expressed in the formula that the people of each territory should have the right to form and regulate their domestic institutions in their own way, subject only to the Constitution of the United States. But the game was so easy, and the price so cheap, that the Southern leaders and their office-hunting Northern tools were not satisfied, even with the gain of territory, and so juggled the bill as virtually to leave all territory open to slavery, even against the will of its people, while eventually they fortified their daring by a Supreme Court decision. The North, on the other hand, angry enough at even the necessity of disputing slavery north of the long-established line, nevertheless began in good faith to prepare to vote slavery out of Kansas by pouring in free settlers. Thereupon ensued one of the strangest duels of modern times, a political battle between two economic systems. On the one side were all the machinery of government, close proximity to the battlefield, and a deep-seated social ideal which did not propose to abide by the rules of the game. On the other hand were strong moral conviction, pressing economic necessity, and capacity for organization. It took 4 years to fight the battle, from the middle of 1854, when the Kansas-Nebraska Bill was passed and the Indians were hustled out of their rights, until 1858, when the pro-slavery Constitution was definitely buried under free state votes. In the beginning, the fall of 1854, the fatal misunderstanding of the two sections was clear. The New England Emigrant Aid Society assumed that the contest was simply a matter of votes, and that if they hurried settlers to Kansas from the North, a majority for freedom was reasonably certain. Missouri and the South, on the other hand, assumed that Kansas was already of right a slave state, and resented, as an impertinence, the attempt to make it free by any means. Thus at Lawrence, on August 1st, the bewildered and unarmed northern settlers and their immediate successors, such as John Brown's sons, were literally pounced upon by the furious Missourians, who crossed the border like an invading army. To those who have qualms of conscience as to violating laws, state or national, the time has come when such impositions must be disregarded, as your rights and property are in danger, cried Stringfellow of Missouri. Thereupon 5,000 Missourians proceeded to elect a pro-slavery legislature and congressional delegate, and led by what Sumner called hirelings picked from the drunken spew and vomit of an uneasy civilization, flourished their pistols and bowie knives, driving some of the Free State immigrants back home and the rest into apprehensive inaction and silence. Snatching thus the whip hand, with pro-slavery governor, judges, marshal, and legislature, they then proceeded in 1855 to deliver blow upon blow to the Free State cause, until it seemed inevitable that Kansas should become a slave state, with a code of laws which made even an assertion against the right of slaveholding a felony punishable with imprisonment. The Free State settlers hesitatingly began to take serious counsel. They found themselves in three parties, a few who hated slavery, more who hated Negroes, and many who hated slaves. Easily the political finesse, afterward unsuccessfully attempted, might now have pitted the parties against one another in such irreconcilable difference as would slip even slavery through. But unblushing force and fraud united them to an appeal for justice at Big Springs in the fall of 1855, where John Brown's sons were present and active, and a declaration of passive with a threat of active resistance to the bogus legislature. A peace program was laid down. They would ignore the patent fraud, organize a state, and appeal to Congress and the nation. This they did in October and November 1855, making Topeka their nominal and Lawrence their real capital. The pro-slavery party, however, was quick to see the weakness of this program, and they took the first opportunity to force the Free State men into collision with the authorities. A characteristic occasion soon arose. A peaceful Free State settler was brutally killed, and instead of arresting the murderer, the pro-slavery sheriff arrested the chief witness against him. A few of the bolder Free State neighbors released the prisoner and took him to Lawrence. Immediately, the sheriff gathered an army of 1,500 deputies from Missouri and surrounded 500 Free State men in Lawrence just after John Brown arrived in Kansas. Things looked serious enough, even to the drunken governor, and with the aid of some artifice, liquor, and stormy weather, the threatened clash was temporarily averted. The wild and ice-bound winter that fell on Kansas gave a moment's pause, but with the opening spring, the pro-slavery forces gathered themselves for a last crushing blow. Armed bands came out of the south with flying banners, the Missouri River was blockaded to northern immigrants, and the border ruffians rode unhindered over the Missouri line. The Free State men, alarmed, appealed to the east, and immigrants were hurried forward. But slavery, with the Chief Justice, the tamed and domesticated Chief Justice who waited on him like a familiar spirit, declared the passive resistance movement constructive treason, and the pro-slavery marshal arrested the Free State leaders from the governor down and clapped them into prison. 2,000 Missourians then surrounded Lawrence, and while the hesitating Free State men were striving to keep the peace, sacked and half-burned the town on the day before Brooks broke Sumner's head in the Senate chamber for telling the truth about Kansas. The deed was done. Kansas was a slave territory. The Free State program had been repudiated by the United States government and had broken like a reed before the assaults of the pro-slavery party. There were mutterings in the East, but the cause of freedom was at its lowest ebb. Then suddenly, there came the flash of an awful stroke, a deed of retaliation from the Free State side, so bloody, relentless, and cruel that it sent a shudder through all Kansas and Missouri, and aroused the nation. In one black night, John Brown, four of his sons, a son-in-law, and two others, the chosen executors of the boldest Free State leaders, seized and killed five of the worst of the border ruffians who were harrying the Free State settlers, and practically swept out of existence the Dutch Henry pro-slavery settlement in the Swamp of the Swan. The rank and file of the Free State men themselves recoiled at first in consternation, and loudly, then faintly, disclaimed the deed. Suddenly they saw, and laid the lie aside, and seized their sharps rifles. There was war in Kansas, a quick, sweeping change from the passive appeal to law and justice, which did not respond, to the appeal to force and blood. The deed did not make Kansas free. No one, least of all John Brown, dreamed that it would. But it brought to the fore in Free State councils the men who were determined to fight for freedom, and it meant the end of passive resistance. The carnival of crime and rapine that ensued was a disgrace to civilization, but it was the cost of freedom, and it was less than the price of repression. There were pitched battles, the building and besieging of forts, the burning of homes, stealing of property, raping of women, and murder of men, until the scared governor signed a truce, exchanged prisoners, and fled for his life. The wildest pro-slavery elements, now loosed from all restraint, planned a last desperate blow. Nearly 3,000 men were mustered in Missouri. The new governor, whose cortege barely escaped highway robbery, found desolation and ruin on every hand. Homes and firesides were deserted. The smoke of burning dwellings darkened the atmosphere. Women and children, driven from their habitations, wandered over the prairies and among the woodlands, or sought refuge and protection even among the Indian tribes. The highways were infested with numerous predatory bands, and the towns were fortified and garrisoned by armies of conflicting partisans, each excited almost to frenzy and determined upon mutual extermination. Not only that, but the territorial treasury was bankrupt. There were no pecuniary resources within herself to meet the exigencies of the time. The congressional appropriations intended to defray the expenses of a year were insufficient to meet the demands of a fortnight. The laws were null, the courts virtually suspended, and the civil arm of the government almost entirely powerless. Governor Geary came in the nick of time, and he came with peremptory orders from the frightened government at Washington, who saw that they must either check the whirlwind they had raised or lose the presidential election of 1856. For not only was there hell in Kansas, but the North was aflame, the very thing which John Brown and Lane and their fellows designed. A great convention met at Buffalo, and mass meetings were held everywhere. Clothes, money, arms, and men began to pour out of the North. It was no longer a program of peaceful voting. It was fight. The Southern Party was certain to be swamped by an army of men who, though most of them had few convictions as to slavery, did not propose to settle among slaves. The wilder pro-slavery men did not heed. When Shannon ran away, and before Geary came, they planned to strike their blow at the Free State forces. An army of nearly 3,000 was collected. One wing sacked Osawatomie, and the main body was to capture and destroy Lawrence. No sooner was this done than the force of the United States Army was to be called in to keep the conquered down. The success of the plan at this juncture might have precipitated civil war in 1856 instead of 1861, and Geary hurried breathlessly to ward off the mad blow. He succeeded, and by strenuous exertions, he was able with some truth to report in Washington before election time, "Peace now reigns in Kansas." The news, though it helped to elect Buchanan, was received but coldly in Washington, for the Southerners knew how high a price Geary had paid. So evidently was the governor out of favor that before the spring of 1857, the third governor fled in mad haste from his post because of the enmity of his own supporters. It was clear to Washington that Geary's recognition of the Free State cause with the heavy immigration had already destroyed the possibility of making Kansas a slave state. There were still, however, certain possibilities for finesse and political maneuvering. Slaves were already in Kansas, and the Dred Scott decision on March 6, 1857, legalized them there. Moreover, southeast Kansas, thanks to one of the most brutal raids in its history in the fall of 1856, was still strongly pro-slavery. The Constitutional Convention was also in that party's hands. By gracefully yielding the legislature, therefore, to the patent Free State majority, it seemed possible that political manipulation might legalize the slaves already in the state. Once this was conceded, there was still a chance to make Kansas a slave state. The pro-slavery men, however, trained in the upheaval of 1856, were poor material to follow and support the astute Governor Walker. They itched for the law of the club, and made but bungling work of the Lecompton Constitution. Then, too, the more determined spirits in the territory, together with many naturally lawless elements, saw the pro-slavery danger in southeast Kansas, and proceeded to wage guerrilla warfare against the squatters on claims where Free State men had been driven. It was a cruel, relentless battle on both sides, with murder and rapine, the last expiring flame of the 4 years' war dying down to sullen peace in the fall of 1858, after the English bill, with its bribe of land for slaves, had been killed in the spring. So Kansas was free. In vain did the sullen Senate in Washington fume and threaten and keep the young state knocking for admission. The game had been played and lost, and Kansas was free. Free because the slave barons played for an imperial stake in defiance of modern humanity and economic development. Free because strong men had suffered and fought not against slavery, but against slaves in Kansas. Above all, free because one man hated slavery, and on a terrible night rode down with his sons among the shadows of the Swamp of the Swan, that long, low-winding, and somber stream fringed everywhere with woods and dark with bloody memory. 48 hours they lingered there, and then of a pale May morning rode up to the world again. Behind them lay 5 twisted, red, and mangled corpses. Behind them rose the stifled wailing of widows and little children. Behind them the fearful driver gazed and shuddered. But before them rode a man, tall, dark, grim-faced, and awful. His hands were red, and his name was John Brown. Such was the cost of freedom. End of chapter 6.